A section number 28361, reel 23.
General Julian Thompson, reel 23.
Did you have any idea of what you were going to do when you came to the end of your time in the Secretariat?
I can't remember how far in advance, but I knew several months in advance. I was going to go down to Plymouth to be what was then called the Brigade Major of the 3rd Commando Brigade.
Was that an attractive prospect?
Yes, because it was regarded as very much a career move within the Royal Marines. It was a sort of tick in the box to command. It was a sort of make or break type job. One or two people had made it, one or two people had broken it, doing it.
Combines the requirements of decision making with staff work, doesn't it?
That's right. I mean, you're de facto the chief of staff. In those days, the BM had an opposite number, the deputy assistant adjutant and quartermaster general, who was the in charge of logistics and personnel.
Yes.
But you were very much the senior guy.
And you were the operations
man and the alter ego of the brigade commander, if you were doing your job properly. And if you did your job properly, you actually ran the brigade in the sense that you implemented the wishes of your brigade commander.
What happened when you arrived there then? How were you briefed and instructed on what you were going to be doing?
Well, I took over from someone I knew already, and I had a week's handover. And he told me what my job was. I mean, I knew more or less what it was anyway, quite honestly. I mean, I dealt with the brigade major in other incarnations, as it were, so I knew more or less what his job was. The interesting thing about that particular period was that the commander brigade had just come back from the Far East. This is early 72. They came back in late 71. And they had just begun to grasp the task which lay ahead, which was the reinforcement of the NATO southern and northern flanks, which was a brand new task, and it required a huge amount of reorientation in the sense that for the previous 3 or 4 years they'd been training to operate in the Far East, using things like fire bases and all the doctrine that was very much sort of copied from the Americans in Vietnam that was current in the Far East. Such minutiae as centralized control of fire support from fire support centers and various arts like eyeball fire control and control of artillery from the sharp end rather than a load of guys sitting around maps at the back end had been slightly forgotten.
Well, I was going to say, wasn't it around about this time that the Americans started faltering in Vietnam, 71, 72, and
absolutely.
People began to question whether or not they'd been fighting the war in the White.
Absolutely. And one of the things I didn't cover, I don't know whether I did cover in my one of the previous thing as secretary, is I did a trip to Thailand to go round various United States Air Force bases to bring myself up to speed on what the Americans were up to in Vietnam.
Yes, but I didn't think you did mention that.
No. Do you want me to talk about that now?
It would be a good thing to.
Well, the Far East was on my desk, and mainly CETO. And one of the things that the worry was that there would be an attack into Thailand. This was one of the plans by North Vietnam or Laos or forces from Cambodia, anyway, coming from Vietnam, i.e., North Vietnamese army. And the one of the tasks was to go out and get myself briefed and up to speed on the thinking out there.
Yes.
And do recces of the various areas. I mean, they were not really proper recces, they were just visits to American Air Force bases from where one was briefed on what, this is in Thailand, briefed on the threat as perceived at the time. But much more interesting, actually, and the Americans found much more fun doing briefing on what they were up to in Vietnam. All from the air side, of course, because we were visiting Air Force bases. So we went to a big base down in the south of Thailand, where they were operating B-52s bombing the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and you see these huge airplanes trundling off down the runway with loaded with bombs, you know, to go off and bomb the Ho Chi Minh Trail. We went to a fighter base where they were doing fighter bomber attacks on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, because at that particular time when we were in on that recce, the bombing of Hanoi was in abeyance. It was going through one of its, you know, sort of, we're not going to bomb them in Hanoi, but we'll bomb them everywhere else. And very interesting, in retrospect, was visiting another base, which was a search and rescue base, where they were, unknown to us at the time, preparing to do the Son Tay raid rescue, which, you remember, was to, the idea was to rescue American prisoners of war held in a place called Son Tay, which actually failed because they'd moved them, not because they were warned about it, but because they just moved them. All these aircraft were lined up, these CH-53s and C-130s, and they told us that this was all part of their rescue setup, which it was in a way, but they'd actually been bumped up with extra people. To answer your question directly, 71, which is when we went, was beginning the beginning of the pullout, and the business of, you know, we'll bomb Hanoi this week and not next week, and dithering that went on.
I think they weren't they using the bombing as a way of trying to exert diplomatic pressure.
Yes.
Were the Paris talks on by that stage?
Yes, they were on. They were continually on, if you remember, at that stage.
Chateau was in Paris.
Yes.
The American view was that they could increase or decrease the bombing in response to
what the Vietnamese North Vietnam were doing. That's right. And if you remember, in the end, this is slightly outside this timescale of 71. They were dithering to the degree the Americans really put the pressure on. That's when they turned the B-52s onto Hanoi. Actually frightened them sufficiently to bring them back to the table.
They hit Haiphong very badly too.
Yes, they did.
Threatening to cut off the line of communication to the Soviet Union. And
yes.
They're putting intelligent mines into the harbour, I think.
That's right. They began to really put the pressure on. I did this very interesting 10 days in Thailand, being briefed on what was going on. But that's a slight red herring from your question.
Did you get the impression the Americans were confident of getting a reasonable outcome to see them in Thailand? The Air Force people you met still.
The impression I got was the Air Force were always pretty upbeat. I think the morale in the, as I perceive it, the morale in the Air Force never took the knock that the morale in the Army, Marines, and Navy took. The Air Force always managed to keep their morale up, from what I could see, and from their sort of briefings and talking to guys who were actually doing it. And despite losses and guys, you know, ending up in what they call the Hanoi Hilton. They did seem to keep their morale up quite high. I suspect the naval aviators were the same. The services that had the lowest morale were those involved in the ground war in Vietnam.
Close contact with the enemy
to
do that.
That's right. And so in my job as brigade major of the Commander Brigade, I came across the American Marines, of course, quite a lot in our NATO dealings, and the morale of the American Marines was pretty low, and they were in a shambolic condition.
Because I remember the American Marines started off having a core area in which they had their own distinctive approach, which was doing quite well, until they were overruled and forced to conform to the Army's way by General Westmoreland, and then they started losing ground.
That's right. They lost ground. They had their own way of doing things, and they were forced to change it, yes.
They had the ink blot tactic.
Yes. They'd done a lot of studying of counterinsurgency, and they had a particularly bright guy called Krulak, who wasn't their commandant, but was very much against the way the U.S. Army was conducting the Vietnam War.
Yes, because the Army seemed to be conducting the war as if it were really simply a scaled-down conventional war.
Yes.
Which it was in some areas, but not others.
Yes, they were unable to...
They couldn't
adjust to the different areas, as I perceived it. I mean, I never served that, but that was my perception.
What about the Air Force? Because the Air Force seemed to have the usual... predilection of air forces for long-range strategic bombing, whereas the ground forces obviously wanted them in close air support as their primary role.
Hmm. I think that the air forces did both.
They did, but I think they would have preferred the strategic if they could have.
I think so, but of course, in a way, the Marines certainly didn't mind because they had their own private air force who did what they were told by them.
Yes.
So they didn't get affected by that.
No.
And of course the army balanced that off by having armed helicopters and gunships and so forth, and that provided their own intimate air support anyway. And I don't recall the airmen that I talked to in Thailand, you know, sort of raising it as a subject.
I've got the impression they preferred Rolling Thunder and Linebacker as other big air offensive.
Yeah.
Well,
they might have done, but that didn't come across in my talking to them, because then I was only talking at sort of pilot level. I wasn't talking to their bosses.
Right. Yeah. The pilot level is always different.
Yeah. They'll do as they're told.
Yeah.
And then they may find it. I mean, after all, actually, you would have a lot more fun and considerably less risk to your own skin doing close air support over South Vietnam than you could bombing North Vietnam, where the chances were if you got shot down, you went into prison.
Did you have any contact with the Thais at all?
Only on the level of the sort of Thai army in a social sense.
Yeah.
The Thais' attitude, as I perceived it, was that they provided these air bases in Thailand, but they weren't actually terribly interested in what went on. Mm. I think they were backing, you know, they were sort of keeping their options open.
Of course. Was the idea then, did you get the idea that there was a serious threat to Thailand from the North Vietnamese? Or did you think this was a rather remote and contingency?
I thought it was a rather remote contingency. I mean, there'd been a CETO contingency plan to reinforce Thailand, which I knew of from my days in the Far East. I didn't think it was all that serious, quite frankly. That was my personal perception.
And was the idea that the Royal Marines would have a role if there were such an attack on Thailand?
Oh yes, the Commander Brigade had a role there, but that wasn't why I was there. I was there in my hat as in the chief's. I'm talking about my previous job. I was there in my hat as the CETO desk officer from the secretariat and looking at it in the round, not just from a Royal Marine point of view. But as far as I remember, the Royal Marines would have had a role with a whole lot of other people had Thailand been invaded. But I don't think that at that stage Thailand was under threat, because the North Vietnamese army was being kept busy enough anyway in Vietnam.
Well, yes, and later on they had the trouble in Cambodia.
Indeed, so they would have plenty of distractions to keep them out of invading Thailand.
Did the chiefs take a close interest in this matter, or was it just something they thought needed to be looked at briefly?
No, I mean, I think they would discuss it occasionally, but not often, once a year.
So your brigade came back,
yeah,
and they were starting to rethink
yes,
how you fight, and you've got this new commitment to the reinforcing the flanks, north and south.
Yeah.
Which flank was considered to be the most likely to require your attention?
In the beginning, both flanks had equal importance. The southern flank faded away later. But to begin with, both flanks had equal importance, and the whole sort of threat was different anyway, in the south to the north.
Let's go through those then. What about the threat to the south, the one that eventually faded?
Yes.
What was the threat there?
The threat to the south was mainly, as I remember, Warsaw Pact attacks into the NATO area, not necessarily the Soviet Union, the Soviet Army, but Warsaw Pact, other Warsaw Pact forces. And so we're talking about the ones in the north of the Balkans, right? The Hungarians, Bulgarians, who were sort of rather were rogue members, or they weren't even members, I don't think, of the Warsaw Pact, but they were rogue communist states. And the worry, I think, there was that a general state of tension would involve incursions by those people into NATO territory. And the idea was that the forces on the southern flank, of which we were part, would, along with the Americans, the Greeks, the Turks, the Italians, reinforce those areas that were under threat using amphibious shipping and or air in order to bolster the host country.
It's rather difficult to conceive of the Greeks and Turks cooperating and doing anything active. So one can imagine that the area around Thrace might be threatened.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
And the area is just from north of it, isn't it?
Absolutely. And of course, Yugoslavia was also regarded as a threat, though, of course, it wasn't a member of the Warsaw Pact. I mean, you know, I think some of the southern flank stuff was pretty pie in the sky, quite frankly.
I mean, Yugoslavia, as I remember it at that time, was a grey area.
Yes.
It had dissented from the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia in 68.
That's right.
I think the NATO Council announced it could not look with indifference or equanimity on the Soviet invasion of Yugoslavia.
That's right. Absolutely. I mean, the Yugoslavia was one of the non-aligned countries, wasn't it?
Yes.
And that's why I'm saying that I always used to think some of the threats that one read in the papers that you... Mm. I don't mean the newspapers, but in the staff papers were really pretty zany, quite frankly. And pretty odd. And
we're in
Raritanian territory. And you're quite right about the Turk-Greek thing, because whenever you designed an exercise in, say, Greek Thrace, the Turks wouldn't play. And if you did an exercise in Turkish Thrace, then the Greeks wouldn't play, mainly because the Turks didn't want them to play. And all the Turkish maps of Thrace were top secret, because they didn't want them to get into Greek hands. And when you walk down the corridor of the NATO headquarters, where I used to go into from time to time, in Izmir, on the left-hand side of the corridor, there were pictures of Turks thrashing Greeks over the centuries. And on the right-hand side, there were pictures of the Greeks thrashing Turks in various battles over the centuries. And there was very little love lost between them. And you never knew when you went on one of these southern flank exercises who was going to turn up. The Americans would turn up, and the Italians would usually turn up, and the Brits would turn up. But you never knew if the Greeks or the Turks were going to turn up. And, of course, you've also got to remember, in those early 70s, it's the time of bubbling trouble in Cyprus. And the Turks hadn't invaded by 1972, which is what we're talking about, but the whole thing was, you know, beginning to rack up.
The tension in Cyprus, to a certain extent, reflect what was going on between Ankara and Athens at the time.
Absolutely, yes. Do you want to let that babble on, or do you want it, just in case it...
What were the areas then in the Aegean or Eastern Mediterranean where you were most likely to exercise and operation?
The exercises in the south, yeah. We tended to exercise in Greek or Turkish Thrace. Yeah. We never exercised on what I call the Asiatic Turkey, as far as I remember. We exercised in the Peloponnese and in Greece, and used to do rehearsals off Crete, and then we used to do national exercises in Cyprus, because it's a big training area in Cyprus.
Peloponnese and Crete.
Yeah.
And what sort of things were you practicing? Were you practicing assault landing?
Yes, yes. They were... The whole business on the southern flank was what I call a sort of military minuet. And it was all predicated around this business of deterrence. You did deterrent landings as a demonstration of intent.
Yes.
And there was a whole sort of thing built into it about how you did in a time of tension. The theory was, I didn't believe it, but this was the theory, was that you got there and then you demonstrated to the Warsaw Pact that you were getting on terribly well with the host nation. You do exercises with them and you did training with them and you did cross-training and you demonstrated that this great organization was you know, thoroughly fit to fight, etc. And so there was a bit of a sort of air of military minuet about it.
Demonstrations.
It was demonstrations. And in addition to that, you then practiced sort of a withdrawal in order to go and land somewhere else. So the game was that it, that the threat died down there and it went somewhere else. And the Americans were very much the drivers of the doctrine, from because they were the major partner. The U.S. Sixth Fleet was the major effort in the Med, and they had they came under a chap called Com Strike Force South, who again was the major part of the world, and they had an American Marine battalion group permanently embarked out there, which they would occasionally bump up brigade size to carry out these exercises. And the actual land play afterwards tended to be a bit of a waste of rations, and that was one of the things my brigade commander was very keen on putting right. And he was a chap called Pat Ovens, a marvellous chap, he's dead now, who'd won an MC in Korea when with 4-1 Commando were attached to the American Marines. And so he actually had a lot of street cred with the US Marines because he'd actually, you know, fought in Korea with them, which helped us enormously because when Pat Ovens sort of said things, they took notice. And he was very conscious that many of the exercises were what I would describe as military minuets and were really totally a waste of time.
You mean that they were, the ground side of it was too ritualized?
Yes,
there
yeah. There was no uncertainty. And really, they were a total waste of time when it came to training anybody. And he tried to change that, and he did have some success in having proper umpiring and free play umpiring and people being picked up for doing things that were tactically unsound, which raised a lot of hackles with the Americans and the Italians and the Greeks and the Turks, who were very conscious of their own sort of amour propre and didn't want to be made to look stupid, which we didn't mind at all because we were quite used to being made to look stupid on exercises. I mean, that's the whole purpose of an exercise, actually, or part of the purpose.
Better to be stupid on an exercise than to be killed by the enemy later.
Exactly. I mean, that was our view. And so he did a huge amount, Pat Ovens, to change the way, the brigade thought, having just gone back to the Far East, and getting it linked into the setup in the southern flank. Remember, we were the Johnny-come-latelys. I mean, this whole southern flank thing had been going on for years, and they're all highly satisfied with their own performance. And then we appeared on the scene and sort of rattled a few cages.
Did the Americans find it difficult to adjust to the new approach to exercising, which involved a certain amount of public humiliation?
Yes, they did find it difficult, and they never really adjusted to it, because the whole way they worked was everything is great. You know, everything is marvellous. Mm. The whole exercise has been a great success, because anything else was they regarded as a threat to their careers, and they didn't like it.
Do you think this reflects the fact that the whole British system of education is based on ritual humiliation?
I don't know. It might be.
So we're used to it. Well, it doesn't worry us, whereas in other societies.
I don't know that is. I don't know the British education is based on that now.
No, maybe not now.
Maybe not now. To its, and it's a loss that it is probably. I don't know.
I mean, the routine sarcasm of the schoolmaster and the beatings and the prefectorial system are all designed to inure one to disappointment and humiliation.
Yes, and our system of training and though not like the American system of recruit training, where everyone is sort of reduced to nothing and then brought up, in later training, I don't think they cover this at all. And there's no one will ever admit that they made a mistake. And everyone's marvellous, which is totally pointless because you don't learn a thing. And we did have a hard time. I don't think we ever persuaded them to totally go to our system. But I remember the first thing that the first big thing that I had to do on joining this brigade was write the exercise which we were going to run. For the first time, we were going to run an exercise in the southern flank. We were going to be the commanding headquarters and run it.
And you were umpiring as well.
We were providing the umpires as well. And one of the first things we said at the end of the exercise is, this is absolutely bonkers. What you actually need is a headquarters that runs it and a headquarters that umpires it. Mm. And so we got that idea brought on board. So some of the time, through the rest of my 2 years in the brigade, we were running a NATO exercise as the commanding headquarters, and sometimes we were the directing staff and sitting away from it, which was a totally new concept to these guys.
What sort of scale of exercise was it? Because you've got your brigade in, that's...
Well, we never took the whole brigade, because we always had someone in Northern Ireland, so the maximum number of chaps we'd have would be two commandos, probably.
So you were a cut-down brigade.
We were a cut-down brigade, with when we'd have perhaps... I'll come on to them in a minute, a Dutch battalion as well. And then we'd have perhaps two batteries of guns, sappers, logistic support. So we'd be, I suppose, a brigade minus with the headquarters. It was a sizable 3,000 strong with helicopters and all the usual other bits and pieces.
What about the other contingents?
Well, the other contingents would be, sometimes you'd get up to a Greek brigade. They had a sort of marine brigade that belonged to their army. You might, if the Turks were playing, you would have anything up to a division of Turks. And then the Americans would vary according to what. The minimum they'd put in would be a battalion group, but they sometimes put in the thing they call a MEB, or a MAB, actually, they call it, a Marine Amphibious Brigade, which was usually built around a regimental combat team. Then the Italians had a thing they called the San Marco Battalion, which was their sort of amphibious, which was a bit of a sort of a bunch of chocolate soldiers, I have to say.
The regimental San Marco.
San Marco, who were pretty useless.
They were Venetian, weren't they?
Yeah, yeah. They had the San Marco Lion as their cap badge or badge. And then there would be sometimes ground forces, and for example, one exercise... in Sardinia, that was another place we exercised in because of the field firing ranges there.
Yes.
And also we exercised in Corsica with the Foreign Legion Parachute Regiment. We did a hell of a lot of exercises in those days.
It sounds as though you were doing a lot around the Med.
Oh, a hell of a lot. And I'll come on to the northern flank. We did that as well, of course.
In Corsica, did you ever have exercise with Troupe de Marine as well as...
No. Never exercised with them. But but going back to Sardinia, quite often, if we were exercising there, we would have Italian army either as enemy or on our side. So you might have, say, a battalion of Bersaglieri and a regiment, or whatever they call it, a battalion of armour. So some of the exercises were quite big, a lot of ships involved, a lot of aeroplanes. And it was very busy times, brigade major, because if you weren't on exercise, you were planning the next one.
Well, that's what troops in theory should be doing.
That's what they should be doing. It was a thoroughly satisfying time. And I don't know how many exercises we did. I haven't sort of counted them, but we never stopped, as far as I remember.
Now, you mentioned that the Americans were full of high opinions of themselves and so forth, but... What was their level of skills?
I don't think they did have very high opinion of themselves. I think their morale was very low post-Vietnam. What I mean was that they'd never admit mistakes. Oh. And everything was marvellous, so they would never criticise anybody. They'd always say, oh, the exercise was great, even if it had been a howling failure. Mm. Because they didn't want to be seen to criticise anything. They didn't want to be picked out for being different, and therefore suspect. And therefore, you know, torpedoing their own chances of promotion.
Yes.
You've never got a... Only occasionally, out of ones that I really knew well, would they ever criticise anything objectively, either you or themselves.
That sounds like a recipe for complacency.
Which is a recipe for complacency. I mean, the morale of the American forces in the early 70s was really low. They had a huge drug problem. They had a huge race problem.
Were those problems evident in the U.S. Marines?
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
They're in discipline, as
you were saying. Oh, yes. I mean, I can remember later than this. Now, as late as 1970, 2008, when I was then a CO, doing an exercise in Sardinia, where my mortar platoon was firing alongside an American mortar platoon, and the chap commanding my mortar platoon, the officer, was away. It was a wonderful trouble, Colonel Sergeant Blythe, who was a very hard nut, came up to